Welcome to the one and only Heavy Hole Podcast. I am Big Will, a.k.a. Uncle Buck. Joining me, he's still special, even though he's my reliably loyal regular co-host, Ian Conies. Welcome back.
Special or not, happy to be here.
Yeah, special. All right. Whoa. I'm going to stop right there, man. Shout out to the rapper Special Ed, man. Ian, welcome back. Good to have you. Your mustache and your sideburns have developed a strong unity with one another.
They have. This is a today thing. I'm about like 2 weeks removed from going back to work, so I figured like, don't pull any punches. Like go full balls to the walls. I'm also going to second year in a row the Philly Decibel Metal and Beer Fest next week. So nice. I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm gonna try a week out from that. See if I like the mutton chop. Like the gross little Lemmy look, and then we'll take it from there. So
it works. That's especially with like the vintage baseball shirt type of thing you got going on now, man. You're a fashionista. I love it. I am not going to the Decibel Beer and Metal or Metal and Beer Fest. Keep an eye out for Hudson. He stands out in a crowd. My drummer from Reeking Ore, tall guy, very tall guy. He's going down there, man. Maybe check him out. I don't go to shows or especially fests that none of my bands are playing because I'm a egomaniac. And nothing matters to me other than the thrill of people. No, come on. I'm just not going this year. I have other things. Work, you know, my family matters or whatever. I wish everybody the best time, down there. There's some great, refresher course the lineup for me, because I'm actually like in my brain thinking that I'm going to start naming bands that played last year or something like that. Cause I'm all mixed up. Well, who's playing again?
So this year, I believe the first night is a little bit more hardcore tinge to it. So Biohazard, I think, is the headliner of the first night. I'm a little less interested in the first night, if I'm being honest. But the other big name on that list, I think, is Crowbar, which I've seen before, but I'm going to have fun at. I could be wrong, but a lot of these bands are playing like special old, like quote, old school sets where they're only going to do stuff from their early discography. I think Crowbar might be on that list. Wow. Then there's some newer bands on that first night as well. I'm also missing a lot, but like Jesus Peace, a few other things with hardcore tinge to it. But the second night, looking forward to as well, because that's going to be I'm trying to think. The newer bands are on, like Tumold is on it, which you guys just played with recently.
Nice guys.
Yeah. Like 200 Stab Wounds is on that. Deva, which is a cool Philadelphia-based, actually, like Black Death project, dizzying guitar work, cool stuff. So check them out. But the big names on that list are Deicide, which will be kind of funny, given the new album's AI artwork and stuff. I wonder if there's any backlash on Deicide being the headliner.
My prediction, they're going to get away with it. It's just going to be the new thing. It's disgusting. I hate that. But yeah, they're going to get away with it.
Yeah, I agree, unfortunately, wholly there. But and then Dying Fetus, who I've seen a bunch, but like I believe Dying Fetus is also only playing stuff from I forget which albums they're only playing stuff from, but
it's old stuff. It's being built. Yeah. I believe Dying Fetus, period. I just believe them. They're true. I believe it. I buy it wholesale. Great band. Lot to unpack with what you just said. Shout to everyone in prison who will be missing the Biohazard, like OG said. There's a lot of a lot of guys doing lockup. A lot of guys upstate wishing they were here for that Biohazard set. I'm going to pour one out for them. Tumult, looking great on the magazine covers. Looking sharp. I like those guys. I enjoy that band's music. It was great for Afterbirth to share the stage with them. Another thing that Afterbirth shares with them, people have opinions about bands on the internet. I don't want to give any shine or point any spotlights anywhere, man. Somebody in the text the other day sent me a little screen cap. Tumult, I guess, took a couple of opinions here and there from people, I guess, for their choice of attire. I just want to say I've never had the privilege of being featured in Decibel. It was Decibel, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I've never had the privilege of being featured in Decibel. I've actually never done anything in my life that would warrant me being featured in a little thing in Decibel magazine or touring Europe or playing MDF or anything like that. I've never done any of that type of work where I would have those opportunities. But shout out to people who do. All I'm saying is, I don't mind that those, like, it's like, I mean, do we, are we really, like, those guys listen to other music besides death metal? We're surprised by that. It's like, what do, you know, I'm sorry, like, dude, shout to Incantation. I mean, do we really need those guys in three Incantation long sleeves up there? Like, it's, you know, I got an Incantation long sleeve. I'll wear it, you know, I mean, but I'm just saying, like, I would, if I got the Decibel magazine, I might rock the Whitney Houston, the Bodyguard soundtrack, you know, promo picture T-shirt, size 4XL that I got from Burlington Coat Factory. That's all I'm gonna say.
I agree, like, with all of that. The one thing I'll say, and also, like, I sit in such a lovely position, not being in a band or in anything where I have to watch what I say. But I want to know who was saying it. Does that make sense? Because it was all, like, faceless people on the internet. And I wonder, is it, like, 18-year-olds that are mad about it? Is it 42-year-olds? Because yeah, if it is, like,
closer,
the latter, which I think it is, that's hilarious to me. Because, like, I don't give a shit. If somebody's wearing something cool, that's, like, a bell and whistle. If I love the guy's shirt on stage, or if I'm like, oh, I like his fucking shoes, awesome, cool, that's all, that's great. If I don't like what they're wearing, that takes absolutely nothing away from it for me personally. And I would just find it hysterical if there's – you know what it is, Will? I was a big Star Wars guy. I think I might have said this on the show before. I used to work in comic book stores in college. Mm. I was like the resident Star Wars Dark Horse Comics.
Yes.
If you have a question about like 70s through 95 Star Wars comics, I know the fucking answer. With all that said, I don't give a fuck what Disney's doing with Star Wars now, because guess what? I'm in my 30s and Star Wars was made for children. So
yeah.
I'm fine with that. Mm. If you're 45 and you're deeply angered by the length of inseam on the short that a guitarist is wearing on stage, I feel for you, man. I'm sorry. I'll buy you a drink if I see you, because you need one. So
I was in a band once where one of the guys got mad at one of the other guys for wearing pajama pants on stage. You just reminded me of that. I said, I don't care. Wear what you want. You got me off track with that. But yeah, I'll tell you once we're off air. 42 was close, but it was actually older. it's that generation, dude. There's a certain generation that kind of came of age when death metal was like in its primordial forms, like, you know, coming out of thrash metal and hardcore and that sort of thing. And it already, just what that sentence I said just there already pissed off a few of them. You know what I mean? They're like, thrash, hardcore, blah, you know, like, but there's those guys. And I've said this, this has become a recurring theme on the podcast. My vocal style in particular is very off-putting to that generation most of the time. I have, like, friends on Long Island who are, like, leather jacket, long hair, old school guys, and they literally tell me, like, your vocals ruin your band, but, like, we're drinking a beer together sometime. Like, that'll happen, man. The guttural stuff, you know? It is what it is, dude. Come on. But listen, Ian, in case you haven't gotten enough of my egomaniacal, self-indulgent, megalomaniacal, even maybe. I don't know. I don't know these terms. We need to get a better educated level of conversation going in here to get to the bottom of all this. Let's just cut the crap right here. I want to talk to Dr. Jess Crook and Dr. Wes Robertson of Lingua Brutalica podcast, who recently had me on as a guest of all people. Let's do it. Big Will from the Heavy Hole Podcast, and I'm here with the two hosts of Lingua Brutalica Podcast, Dr. Jess Crook and Dr. Wes Robertson. Welcome to the Heavy Hole Podcast, and thank you for your time.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thank you.
Of course, it's an honor and a privilege. As I just told you guys behind the scenes, and all due respect to anyone else who has ever given me the time before, but you guys did quite possibly the best interview, or my favorite interview that I was ever part of. But I think it's also a little bit of an unfair advantage by way of the nature of what you do. And we're going to get into that. I believe the correct term for your your earned term, your doctorate, I guess that would be the right right terminology. You got to go slowly with me. I'm not a well-educated man. Would be you are sociolinguists.
Yes.
Yeah, correct.
Okay. And according to my research, just for laymen such as myself, that is the study of how social factors impact language use, no?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Basically.
Perfect.
All right. We're, we're starting slow for the gore grind people.
Yeah.
I'm just playing, guys. And as I usually do on the podcast, I'm going to ask you guys a little bit about, you know, each of your backgrounds, respectively, because the way that your podcast all came together is not only are you sociolinguists, but much like just about everyone else in the picture here, listeners included, you're metalheads. You enjoy heavy music. Mm-hmm. And the cultures of this, and you've really explored it in an interesting way in your podcast, of which I was episode 52. So just to give the listeners right off the rip here too, you've interviewed members of Psycroptic, Horrendous, Fallujah, Hellripper, Sciotoxin, Archspire, and many more. You know, myself being 52, one of the latest episodes. So I encourage people to go back and binge listen. You're not going to regret it. But starting before all of this, I'm just going to start, Dr. Jess Crook. What are you from a family in which music was part of your upbringing, an appreciation for music, and even hard rock and heavy metal?
Yeah, so my dad is a musician. So music has always like been present in my life since, you know, I was very young. So he was a guitarist, not in a, you know, a rock band or even, you know, a hard rock band or anything like that. He was a like jazz musician. But I think I was around music a lot. And so I had an appreciation for music from a really young age, I would say. And so I think because of that, I've always been attracted to music that is technically interesting. And I think, you know, metal certainly fits into that trend.
Okay. And at around what point in your life do you start taking a turn for like the more, I don't know if you'd say underground, but maybe the less commercially available music and the harder and heavier music, and discover that there's this world of like independent and underground metal?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. So yeah, obviously when I was like growing up in the like late 90s, early 2000s, that was during like the boom of nu metal. So nu metal was like very accessible. But in terms of turning towards that more kind of like underground, like extreme metal, I think that was initiated when I went to my local public library. And at my local public library, there was this area where you could like just borrow CDs and stuff. And I don't know who stocked that. But it was just like kind of a random selection of like music and stuff, no, you know, kind of particular genre affiliation or anything. And I happened to just stumble across Cradle of Filth's Damnation in a Day. You know, borrowed that, took it home, burnt it, the whole, you know, shebang, and was like, oh, wow, this is amazing. And I think like from there, that's what kind of like led me to discover more, you know, like black metal, death metal, like thrash, that kind of thing. And, you know, then from there, then you obviously, you know, you start listening to that music, you start meeting people, you know, in your environment and stuff that are interested in that kind of music. And that's when I started going to shows. So this is around when I was like 15, 16. Yeah. So that's kind of the origin story of my relationship to the subculture.
Okay. Damnation in a Day. That's an interesting use of alliteration. Am I inferring too much too soon with that?
No, that's okay. That's totally it. Damnation in a Day. Love a bit of alliteration, as do many of the people that we feature on the podcast.
Is there an interest going back to your childhood or to your young adulthood in languages? How do you set out on the course also of becoming a sociolinguist? Where does that come from?
Well, I grew up, like the area where I grew up was like pretty multilingual. There was a lot of people from migrant backgrounds and stuff. So I was exposed to a lot of different languages like in early life and was really interested in learning languages. I think because a lot of my friends spoke languages other than English. And originally, like I came from just an English language home. I thought it was like really amazing that they could speak like other languages. And so that was something that like I really wanted to do. It's like they had a superpower that I didn't have. And I was like, oh, that's really cool and amazing. I want to like learn how to do that. And I think that's like how I gravitated towards initially just like learning a couple of languages, specifically Indonesian, because that was really popular when I was growing up in primary school. And then, you know, later learned French and then Mandarin Chinese. And I think, yeah, once I realized that not only like was learning languages really interesting to me, but I seemed to have like a bit of an affinity for like picking them up quickly. I realized that that was something that, you know, I wanted to spend more time on and then eventually specialize in.
Oh, okay. Now, I have struggled to learn other languages. I know a little bit of kind of like common Spanish that people might use here on Long Island or something like that. That's interesting to me. And Wes, I'm going to get to you in a minute, but I just want to know, you know, you said I'm sorry, you said Mandarin? That I mean, that's not one for starters, right? I mean, that's I've gotten the impression from what I've, you know, seen and heard that that's a very difficult language to learn, especially for a native English speaker, no?
Yeah, I did find it difficult, especially because, you know, you're working with like a different script. And of course, like Wes can speak to that experience being like a Japanese lecturer. But yeah, it was definitely challenging. But I suppose one of the benefits of having already had the experience of learning Indonesian and French was that I think I'd already kind of developed a system around how to learn languages effectively by the time I got to Mandarin when I was, you know, already like a young adult, like in my undergrad.
How?
And I don't want to downplay like the difficulty of Mandarin or anything at all, but it actually like the grammar is pretty straightforward in some ways.
That
Like
is
I would
true.
rather learn I've learned a tiny bit of Spanish because just growing up in America is what you do, right? And I would rather learn Mandarin than learn Spanish verb conjugations. Like you know, so what's difficult for one person in learning a language could be easy for another person. So there's no like it's hard to talk about objective difficulty with a language. Although, you know, certainly tones in the writing system do make Chinese, you know, put some hurdles there that, you know, Spanish
Challenging,
doesn't.
yeah.
I'm not saying it's easy anyway, but their verbs are great. Chinese verbs are awesome.
Yeah, I love that. No chance, great.
Okay, I'm a little bit underwater in this conversation, but maybe this is a good point. Jess, if you'll hold on a second. Dr. Wes Robertson, a little bit of the same type of questioning for you. In your family, does music play a role, even maybe hard rock and heavy metal growing up? And then also, how far back into your childhood does this interest in language go?
My parents both like music, but it's music that I don't like, which I don't, you know, like my mom really likes musicals and classical music, and I don't. Like classical music makes me fall asleep. I don't dislike it. It just makes me like I don't it doesn't give me the kind of energy, you know? And my dad likes folk, and the hardest stuff would be like stuff like the Stones and whatever, which is, you know, it's fine. But even like Led Zeppelin isn't something I heard growing up a lot. So I started with I'm a white dude from like middle class America, grew up in the 1980s, you know, so it was like pop punk into nu metal. It was the basic thing, you know. Korn was blowing my mind. When Slipknot reduced Iowa, I was like, this is too heavy for me. What's going on? And I grew up in a small town, so like I had no one around me to like guide me. There was like the goth kids listened to Type O Negative, but they scared me and didn't want to hang out with me because I was a nerd. And then there was like the one kid who wears a Burzum shirt, and that was too scary. And also, you know, now that it's Burzum, I don't want to listen to it. But it was all just, you know, navigating that. And then, ironically enough, the first like heavy album that I had, and I'm like 2 or 3 years older than Jess, is the album Cradle of Filth, released 2 or 3 years before Damnation of the Day, which is Midian. And that was like the first like really heavy thing that I was like, oh, okay. And then slowly I started, especially in, I had a bass teacher that was into industrial. So like Ministry, KMFDM, that kind of stuff was just a little bit heavier, you know, than the nu metal stuff. Early Ministry was mind-blowing for me. And then this is gonna make me sound like a poser, but the real jump was I stumbled on a an MTV Headbangers Ball album at Hot Topic, and the first half was all these nu metal songs that I really, really liked, and then the second half was like all these bands I never heard of. But I was like, two CDs for the price of one, let's go. And I remember in my car I put it on, and the first track was From Nothing by Meshuggah. I think it was like Stranga, or and I just like absolute mind opening. Like, oh my God, this is, I've never heard anything. This is exactly what I've been like looking for. And after that, it was just kind of a rabbit hole.
Okay, and then the second part about language and interest in language.
Oh, so I like reading. I was a fantasy, like I just read and read and read. I loved fantasy novels, sci-fi a little bit too, but I was just a voracious reader. I went to uni for initially for creative writing. I did English lit and creative writing, and I didn't have any real knowledge of linguistics, but I took a linguistics class by chance because I started studying Japanese in uni as well, and I was like, okay, this looks cool. I took it as elective. I really liked it, but I didn't think I was gonna, I didn't major in it. But then very later in life, I realized that I wanted to kind of take language study. I started gravitating more to the Japanese study than the literature stuff I was doing. And I was like, what do I do if I want to learn more about a language? Because you can't look at a PhD and just like learning to speak a language really good. Like that's not a job, right? So I started looking at linguistics and actually bought like a bunch of introductory, you know, my first linguistics kind of books. I was like, this stuff is really interesting. And then went to the same uni that Jess went to and ended up going to some lectures and stuff that introduced me to sociolinguistics. And then it's just been like, oh, this is like, you know, exactly what I want to do.
And just for myself and the listeners who the, you know, this is kind of a different thing for, like, what you know, you said before, you know, that's not a job, just, you know, being good in a language. What type of work do you do, and what type of research do you do, you know, outside of this podcast, which I take it is more of a passion project for you?
Yeah, the podcast is like passion project slash research project. Like, our universities do consider it research in kind of an informal way, and we've turned it into research in a more formal way. But in the day-to-day, like our jobs are involved in a lot of things. Some of it's like admin, which is not fun, like grading and sending emails. Some of it's teaching languages. I teach Japanese, Jess teaches Indonesian. And then we do research on language, which is like trying to uncover new information about how languages work, especially the intersection between the social part of it, like how people using language. I guess a simple way is we look for how people gain meaning from language that isn't in the words themselves. Like, you know, you, me, Jess, we all have accents, right? So when people listen to us speak, they might assume we're from places, as a very simple example. But we haven't said where we're from, yet that information is still conveyed. So that's social. And there might be mistakes. Like I get asked if I'm Irish regularly by Australians, and I'm not like at all, but I have a red beard. So it, even if the information is wrong, it still is information that's created, right? And then people navigate that. So like, what is a polite sentence? Those kind of questions are really, really difficult to answer because it's not just saying please. If I say like please shut the fuck up, right? That's not polite. If I'm like oh please, that's not polite. So it's picking up how do people intuit this information that is not literally in the sentence, and how does that relate to life being a human?
Wow, that's a lot right there. And I couldn't help but smile and laugh to myself a little bit, knowing, just being fully conscious of my own accent while you were saying all that.
Jess loves your accent, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, facts, I do.
Thanks. It's not as popular with everybody, but people do know where I'm from the second I open my mouth, in all 50 states. A lot of the time, I've traveled a lot of the country, and people, Long Island. Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Just kind of a fact question here, I guess. If each of you would mind taking a turn, how many languages do you currently speak fluently, and how long, on average, would it take you to learn a new language, just picking it up from not knowing it at all?
Oh man, I don't know. So I speak two fluently, and I have an embarrassingly pathetic understanding of Spanish from high school Spanish and living in you know Utah, where there are fairly high number of Spanish speakers. Picking up a new language, man, I don't know. It depends on the language and
Yeah.
depends on how much time I have. Right now, given my normal schedule, it'd probably take me decades. It took me. So I speak English and Japanese, and I'd say it took me about 8 years until I felt I was very skilled in Japanese. I've been speaking it now for 20. I don't know if I'm at my strongest or not, but like it's just part of my life now. To pick up a new one, I don't know. Like the next one, I'd probably really want to learn really to be Chinese or Korean, and I imagine that would take me at least, 5 or 6 years of good concentrated effort, assuming I actually have the time. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I think I'd probably make a similar suggestion because I mean it is really, really hard to say exactly how long it's taken me to learn languages that I know. So I do speak obviously English, French, and Indonesian fluently. I'd say my Mandarin is more conversational, but all of those languages I've spoken for a really long time. And I suppose it depends on how you define fluency as well. Like at what point, like you'd consider yourself fluent, like I suppose, like if we consider fluent to be the stage at which you have like achieved kind of communicative competence in that you can like express what you want to express, say what you want to say, and be understood. That I think I don't know. I suppose on average, I guess yeah, it really depends on the context, maybe more than the time. As in like number of years. I think I'd be able to pick up a new language relatively quickly if I was living and operating in a situation where I was using that language constantly. So, for instance, when I worked in Indonesia for a while, when I was doing my PhD, I was able to pick up the local language quite quickly, but that's because I heard it all the time, like every day, and had to kind of operate in a mix of the national language and that language on a day-to-day basis. Whereas I don't think I would have necessarily been as successful picking up all of that kind of new vocabulary. Had I just been working from, my home here in Australia. Do you know what I mean? So, it's not a very good answer. Not a very satisfying answer, is
No, I agree though, because like if you like took me in and like put me in, I don't know, Seoul and made my job learn Korean,
Yeah.
because I have a background in learning languages, because I've learned Japanese, which has a similar grammar now, so that whole mind-blowing part is, I can skip that. And I would have the time and focus and the knowledge. I bet I could cut the time I said earlier in half, if not more. But that's in Australia, then that the time's gonna go up a lot.
Yeah,
I
definitely.
wish someone would
Not
pay
to
me
mention,
to learn that language. That'd be great.
we should also add though that this is like a common myth about linguistics that like all linguists have to speak multiple languages.
Oh yeah.
I'd say we are the exception rather than the rule. Especially in Australia, there are a lot of linguists who just speak one language. So just speak English, for instance, or have like kind of passing knowledge of other languages that they've studied but don't necessarily like use to communicate.
That used to be a huge problem too, because people would like say, this is how English works, and therefore I can extrapolate this to every language. And fortunately, that doesn't happen anymore, so it's not really a problem. And if you're an English linguist specialized in English, then great.
Okay, all right. And I'm learning here. To counter what you said about it being a bad answer, I would say I was asking a question, with the wrong terms. That probably, trying to pin down what you're doing, with the wrong terms. So I'm trying to get a better understanding, I guess, of what exactly it is you do. Moving on, though, I mean the kind of common link here, and what people who may have listened to Lingua Brutalica's episode with me found out is how much you guys really do have a passion for metal, and how much you devote of your podcast to it. With the analytics you do and the type of statistics you come up with, I imagine there's some sort of like algorithmic, like analytical program maybe you use, and I'd like you to comment on that. He's shaking his head no, because this is the
No.
real question. How much time goes in. Do you really sit there and read all of the lyrics and take notations and all of that? Let's get into that if you each want to give your take on that.
Yeah, we do. We don't use any programs other than like Microsoft Word Control F.
Very
Find,
useful.
Microsoft Word Control F, fuck. Okay, so you used fuck 8 times throughout your entire discography. Like, okay. No, we don't use any programs. We read all the lyrics. When it's a band like someone like you, who is not only in one band that has, three plus albums, but like five, it's a sizable time commitment. Whereas we just interviewed Brat, who is a band that's doing some really cool stuff. And they have like 2 EPs with 4 tracks on it and one album coming out. So that's a lot easier, right? I remember we did like Cynic took a long time because they have got like a huge discography. So it all depends, but yeah, we read all the lyrics that a band has written. And
Yeah.
the first step for me is just one of us takes the lead on preparing, and it just kind of goes back and forth depending. It's usually like, okay, you did the last one, but if someone's really busy, then someone will do two in a row, whatever. And the first step for me is just I just read all the lyrics straight through, once, and just try to kind of get the vibe, and then start more analysis.
Wow. Okay. Is there, in that case then, is there like online, there's a few, there's several websites that are like lyric databases. Is there a preferred one that you use, or how do you get the lyrics?
Yeah, I'd say Encyclopedia Metallum has got to have a massive shout out just because they have probably the largest repository of lyrics that I've seen just in like a single place online. They are very good. Sometimes Bandcamp, obviously, some people do upload their lyrics on Bandcamp. That's quite useful as well. And I think we have recently used Metal Kingdom. Those are the kind of main resources, and occasionally Genius as well, but I don't like the layout of that as much
No,
personally.
Genius makes life really hard for us. Yeah. And every once in a while we just email the band and say, hey, can you send us your lyrics? And they do, and that's a huge lifesaver because
That's
then it's
true.
nice.
Yeah,
Yeah.
particularly for like stuff that hasn't been released, that obviously is a really important resource.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Metal Archives coming through again, man. Shout out to Metal Archives, a huge resource for this podcast as well. I will always acknowledge that. And if I could get one of those cryptic figures behind the scenes who's up high at Metal Archives on, maybe that they're well. I'll hide their voice, like the old, expose shows.
It
Is really frustrating though. Like, I don't mean to clock Metal Archives because they're doing great work, but like, man, when they don't allow a band on for like some arbitrary reason, and so that like none of the resources are available, it's so like, oh man, it just drives me up the wall. Like they're like, no, this band isn't metal because they released a hardcore album 8 years ago. And it's like, God, come on, like this is
Yeah. Splitting
it's the
hairs really,
best,
yeah.
yeah, it's the best resource available, but it gatekeeps like some bands for like reasons that just blow my mind. And then like Slipknot will be on there, and it's like, okay.
Yeah, there are some. Yeah, that's the thing is there are some bands that are like hard to justify that are on there. My band Buckshot Facelift was, like my guitarist one time was trying to get us on there, and they said that we were too much on the punk hardcore side of grind. And then we put out an album that had significantly more death metal parts, and they put us on there.
I mean,
Yeah, so I mean,
if they
I've
said
been
that,
there.
it's true, right? Like they're the
Yeah.
arbiters, they get to they decide what is and is not metal.
Yeah, so I mean, I crossed that bridge, and it's kind of I've thought of it too, though. Like, and I'm not just saying this because they let my band in, but it's almost like at a certain point, it's like if they start letting certain bands in, then they have to let like every single power violence and grindcore band in the whole world in, and it's gonna be so much work. But I don't know. Maybe that's a conversation for if I get them on. I wanted to pick both of your brains a little bit about yourselves as metalheads, really, and maybe how your work and your research affects that. The I'm very I you know, and maybe I don't mean to, respectfully, I'm saying this. I thought maybe there was some sort of program that you were running this through, and I'd obviously I'm getting the impression now that that would probably be frowned upon given the nature of your your jobs as researchers and your studies.
No, I wouldn't say it's frowned upon. There's a lot of like really, really good, really powerful linguistics research programs. I just don't think they're adapted to like analyzing 4 or 5 albums worth of lyrics.
Yeah.
It's kind of like overkill.
It's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, we could, I mean, and there's kind of like a limited applicability of a lot of that kind of software. I mean, there are programs like AntConc that can indicate like how frequently a particular word appears in a series of like a data series and that kind of thing. But I mean, obviously that doesn't necessarily give you any more information than just Control F in Word, at least for our purposes,
Yeah.
because we're not looking at things like collocations and that kind of thing. So, a lot of the software out there, I think, is just not applicable to the kind of work that we want to do with these like
Yeah.
lyrics.
And when we write papers, like when we use data, we have used data from the podcast to write papers, to write books. And when that happens, we use like software to help us code themes and like identify specific quotes and kind of group things together in a way that helps us analyze it and unpack it. But when we're doing the podcast itself, like lyrics haven't been a traditional target of like linguistic inquiry. It's more like speech or writing that's meant to resemble speech. So some of the tools aren't like adapted to what we're doing. And then also, because we're interviewing about things like themes and poetry, kind of, I guess, like a literary studies aspect kind of comes in there. And to get good questions about that, we got to read it. We can't trust that to the computer. I don't want the computer telling me what your themes are. I want to try to understand them myself, even if I'm wrong, because that gets us a conversation, right? Whereas, like, the AI told me that you talk about the environment. It's like, that's.
Not to mention like our own familiarity with the genre obviously like influences like how we formulate questions as well. So I think like that's not something that you could recreate like with any kind of like AI or software that obviously isn't like programmed to have that same kind of recognition of like common metal themes and motifs.
We were lyric kids too. We were the, you know, there's the middle people that put the album on and then throw away the lyric book, right? We were the ones that were like, "Ooh, what's he saying? You know, pour it over there." Ooh, Danny Filth, you use big words. Good job.
Well, on that note, that's a good point here. Then, one of the questions I had, if you could each take a turn, then on that note, what are some of your personal favorite metal lyrics? Kind of in the same way you asked me to name a couple of bands or albums. And also, I wanted to know if there's any lyrics or any bands you find off-putting because of this, specifically because of the lyrics in particular.
I mean, yes. Favorite lyric, like I love Rest in Peace, but Black Dahlia Murder. I think just absolutely Trevor is a fantastic lyricist. I really like what How the Decapitation does. I think they have a very, great approach. And like I mentioned Danny Filth, getting older, some of his lyrics don't vibe with me the same when I was like a 17-year-old boy with a lot of angst, but I still think he's incredibly good at like putting a phrase together. I think like I don't it's everyone we've interviewed I think has something interesting. I remember one that really blew me and Jess away because we were only somewhat familiar with the band, but we loved their lyrics was Warforged. I think you've had them on this podcast. They had like a kind of Charles Bukowskian like the absurdity of the day to day, like one of their lyrics of like throwing just what was it, like a brick on a car or something, just
Yeah,
randomly.
throwing a brick into the middle of the road or something like that.
Yeah,
Yeah, it
just
was
like this
just.
weird, like suburban misery and like absurdity that was really fun. So I like things that are fresh, but I do like people that have the kind of that sort of literary flair to it. And as for things I don't like, obviously anything that's just really vile. When I was younger, and kind of trying to rebel against the small town I grew up in, I thought that like being vile for the sake of being vile had meaning, and maybe it did in the 1990s, but if in 2023, if you're writing a song about, just rampant sexual violence or whatever, any kind of stuff like that, it's gore as well. It has to be done really well. I Cannibal Corpse gets a pass for me because they've been doing it for so long, and two, I do think they do it well. I think that they know what they're doing. And it's tricky. Even stuff like, some Black Dahlia Murder songs that I really, really enjoy, the topics are not ones that like I can say I like this song. It's about, this scene from Evil Dead that is, pretty horrible. I don't know. That's been something I've had to kind of work through as I've gotten older. But I still appreciate what it's done with some kind of artistry, and especially when I think that the theme is being explored for a reason, beyond just, haha, I have shocked you, like, great. It's the jump scare of metal, right? Like, ooh, stab, stab, organs are out. Haha, you're shocked. Like, okay.
Yeah,
Cool.
and if the jump scare happened for you like 30 years ago, it's definitely lost effect.
The first person who ever used a jump scare, like, good. Good job. It's a technique. Well done, But if your movie's full of jump scares and 40 years later, it's like, come on. Give me something like The Witch instead of something like, Paranormal Activity.
Fair enough. Jess, you want to take a turn on that one?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think I would agree that I do kind of gravitate more towards lyrics that have a kind of like poetry. I think especially maybe like what's key for my enjoyment of lyrics is more like if I can see that the artist was really kind of interested or like passionate about like what they're writing about. I think that comes out in a lot of like Danny Filth's lyrics, is like having a particular like interest in like a topic that's like inspired the lyrics for like one of Cradle of Filth's albums and stuff. I mean, I love like the Nymphetamine lyrics, probably some of my favorites. Yes, so I think that kind of kind of literary quality I think is very appealing. We saw that in another example from our podcast, in Fairies lyrics. I also really enjoyed just like so many layers of like wordplay, such an enormous amount of thought like that Stevie puts into those. I think is really laudable, and also just really interesting. But on the other hand, though, I do still like enjoy lyrics from bands like Exhumed and Carcass and that kind of thing, that don't necessarily have that same like poetic quality, but I think do still like convey like interest in the topics that like each of their albums kind of like focus on, as well as a kind of like fun wordplay and that kind of thing that I think is really enjoyable. Oh, another good example from non-English context. I really, really love Thonic's lyrics. I think they are incredibly like beautifully written, really interesting from like a political and historical perspective. Like Freddie Lim does an enormous amount of research before like writing lyrics for his albums. And so I guess maybe like the common like through line there is like I suppose like artists who've put a lot of effort into their lyrics, such that like if you go to the effort of like pulling out the lyric book and actually reading the lyrics, this is something that you can get from that. You can learn something new. I think that's something I find really appealing.
That effort comment I think is really key. Like Carcass does gore, in my opinion, right? Because it's clear that there's
Yeah.
like a lot of thought. Like it's disgusting. Like what Vomited Anal Tract. Like that's a horrible. Like you can't say like, yeah, I love this song called Vomited Anal Tract. Check it out. But like the amount of thought and like wordplay and even rhyme that goes in, and
And
mentioning
research,
yeah, and research. Like the dude had to look up all those terms. There's like a Cattle Decapitation song where they suddenly give like the scientific names for a bunch of sea animals, and it's like just the effort that goes into adding that is great. And with a band like Inferi, right, that you have that the tech death thing, so everyone in the band, like the drummer, the bassist, the guitarist, they're putting all this effort in. If Stevie is just like stab stab stab, it wouldn't work, but it does work because he puts in the same like it, and Archspire too, I think.
Yeah, Aspire is
Everyone
a
in the
really good
band is
example.
going like 500 times what they need to. And so the singer matches it by not only in the speed that he produces the lyrics, but like the difficulty of getting words that big out that fast is really cool. And it's nice to see like the entire band. I think like metal is an effort heavy genre, right? And it's nice to see bands, the vocalist all also putting effort into not only how they growl, but what they're growling.
Yeah, and I think that's a really like important point for us as well. Like, in the kind of work that we do is that I think we're always kind of like butting up against like the idea that metal is kind of a genre for people who are either anti-intellectual or are kind of boneheaded and stuff. And I think that that's something that we've like consistently disproven in
Yes.
like a lot of our interviews and our work. It's like that I think the if in fact like the opposite is probably closer to the truth. I'd say it's like actually like deeply intellectual, even if it's not in like a traditional kind of academic sense. And yeah, I'd certainly say that like comes across in a lot of the lyrical content.
Okay, so now obviously, as you said, you were the people, as metal fans who've been reading the lyrics. It's not like you just started reading the lyrics, but in doing Lingua Brutalica podcast and interviewing artists about their lyrics, myself included, were there any misconceptions either in general about metal artists and lyricists or anything, or about specific people? I just want to know, like, were there any like total misconceptions, things you learned along the way, things that maybe flipped your views on a certain band or something along those lines, if either of you want to take a stab at that.
I thought we'd have more people that straight up admit that they're trying for like a metal vibe. And people maybe look, I when you interview someone as a researcher, you never take what they say 100% at face value. You have to try to be a little objective. So I understand that maybe people are a bit embarrassed to be like, I was trying really hard to be metal, man. That's why I did that, right? But a lot of people are, even if they say like, look, I am, paying homage a bit there. A lot of people are just, they're just interested in these, from their perspective, they're just interested in these themes. And so these kind of phrases happen to go out, but their actual motives are often like really, really personal, and related to something, even sometimes like a really intense individual experience. And that's been kind of cool to see. There have been people that say, oh, it's just like, I like black metal, so I was doing a black metal thing. And that's cool to hear too. But I'm amazed at how rare. There are times where I've been like, this is literal just like metal kind of worship, right? Like, no, that's actually, yeah, I like dark things, so I write dark, but this is relating to this instead, or like this is inspired by this, which has nothing to do with metal, but metal. I guess to wrap this up, I've gone from thinking people are trying to be metal to people appreciating that metal allows them to do things that they wouldn't be able to do elsewhere. Like, I now see metal as a space which welcomes certain things rather than a space which applies pressure. Although there have been people that say, again, I felt pressured by, metal. Like some people who use smaller words, like, oh, I'm worried I get criticized because metal has so many big words. But nevertheless, that pressure is less than just people embracing metal as a space that allows them to do things in language they wouldn't be able to do elsewhere. And that's really cool to me.
Yeah, I think that's a really good one. I think the other one that maybe has come up a lot as being quite interesting to us has been just patterns around like swearing. So I think we're probably like subconsciously aware of the kind of lack of swearing in a lot of lyrics. But I think like because you're constantly confronted with the perception at least that like metal is this space where like there's infinite level of kind of vulgarity and stuff that you kind of anticipate there being like a high level of like swearing, dysmism, and grotesque expression and that kind of thing. And it seems like from what we've seen that like the trend is kind of the reverse really, which I think if, especially coming from an Australian perspective is really interesting just because swearing is such a part of our daily life here. And in fact, like when we've spoken to Australian musicians, I'd say they are some of the most averse to swearing in their lyrics. Like totally not interested in it at all, despite the fact that like they are some of the people that will swear the most in their everyday life. And I think maybe more broadly we could also say that was something else that yeah, maybe not was totally surprising, but I guess like we got kind of more information on was just the contrast between the kind of language that people use for lyrics and how distinct that is from the language that they use in everyday life.
Okay, a lot there. That a question comes to my mind then, from what you just said. According to your research, your perspectives, just picking your mind a little bit more in terms of what you do for a living, what role does swearing play on a day-to-day basis, and why, in your opinion, do you think that people who swear in their daily lives, like you just said, would separate that in the lyrics? Like what's the greater importance of swearing in language, and how does that play into that?
Dude, that's like a there are entire there are multiple books
I know,
answering that
I'm
question.
sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
So,
Loaded question.
all right. So for in sociolinguistics, a key kind of perception that we have to set here that we're starting with is that you don't have like one identity. You have multiple identities. There's not like whatever is your core is never like always active. Like you're always people like who you are at work, who you are at school, who you are with your friends, who you are in front of your kids. These are all different identities, and they may share attributes, but they're different. And none of them are like fake. It's not like, oh, at work, it's my fake identity. They're all, if you spend 8 hours a day, 5 days a week doing something, it's part of you, right? So language, when you have a choice of what to say, so whether or not you add fuck to a sentence is a key choice. You are producing certain identities, and what identities you produce are going to be depending on how you understand things. So if you come from a very formal perspective, or what we call a linguistic ideology, someone who swears is vulgar, right? That person swore, therefore they are vulgar, they are low class, they are uneducated, they are stupid, they are criminal, right? But that's not obviously the case. And indeed, a lot of the metal people we've interviewed say they don't swear to be offensive because they're not swearing to an audience that is even offended by these things, right? Like if you have fuck you in a lyric, at a metal show, who's it going to offend? Tipper Gore, she's not there, right? So swearing can produce other identities such as camaraderie, a more relaxed identity, a class-based identity, these kind of things. So why someone swears is always going to be very, very individual, and it's going to vary in context. I don't swear very much at work, but there may be times where a certain swear word can try to produce like the chill professor, right? Or like, relax things a little bit. But then when I'm hanging out with my friends, there you go. If I'm talking to the prime minister, I'm probably not going to swear, although it is Australia, so I don't know, Jess, would that
Probably
fly?
right.
Probably be all right. Yeah. So it's tricky. What does swearing mean? That depends on you. That depends on context. And when I swear in one context, maybe my friends accept that as like, oh, he's swearing because like this is our chill, friendly identity. But someone walking by may invalidate that, and we're all right. Like no one's wrong.
I think some of those language ideologies actually help explain why there's not a lot of swearing in lyrics. So for one thing, I think one of the reasons that we've seen people kind of avoid swearing is because they think that it kind of lessens the kind of like seriousness of the lyrics, brings it to like a too much of a kind of like colloquial or kind of jokey space when it's like supposed to be taken as something that's like a little bit more serious. Other reasons could be, yeah, like because swearing is kind of associated with like a lack of like intellectualism, then that could be another reason to avoid it. I think the other reason that we commonly see swearing avoided though has more to do with like genre convention. So in the context of like writing like metal lyrics, I mean, it seems like a lot of people think that if you were to, include a lot of like swear words, that would kind of be counter to the genre conventions of just like writing lyrics for a song. Even just like we can think about it in terms of modality as well. So like even just like the idea of writing like a swear word down, when you're like preparing your lyrics and stuff, I think to some people like it's a little bit like odd, because swearing is something like that, if we're talking about it in contrast with daily life, swearing is something that's usually quite spontaneous. And so for some people, like the act of like kind of like pre-planning like a swear word and inserting it into the lyrics, like, is a little bit like too like try hard and inauthentic. I think that's, that also plays into it. So I think it's a combination of those kind of language ideologies around like, what do people think that swearing means in terms of whether or not that means that they are like uneducated, or it means that their lyrics are unserious, or unimportant or joking or whatever. And, whether or not that swearing is supposed to be something that just like happens in the heat of the moment as a kind of emotional display, and whether or not that can be recreated in a way that reads as authentic if you were to write it down as part of a like lyric sheet.
And it's kind of like a hopefully pretty straightforward example. What Jess was mentioning earlier about Aussie singers, it's like when they're on stage doing banter, they'll swear a lot because they're trying to put forward this, a metal front person identity, or maybe even, Australian pub in a pub hanging out identity, right? But then in
Yeah,
their
where humor's
lyrics,
really important. Yeah.
yes. But then in their lyrics, they're trying to put forward a metal lyricist identity. And that metal lyricist identity is different from the front person identity. And that identity does not swear. So like when they're trying to like, look at me, I am a lyricist, no swearing. And then it's like, I'm done singing. Now I'm a front person and I'm trying to get the crowd going. And I'm also trying to be like, yo, we're all Aussie metal fans in this context. Then swear words start to come out quite a bit.
I'm learning. I'm kind of looking at my own behavior and my own, use of lyrics and what you said about, being individualized. It all makes a lot of sense. So, let me ask you this, because I do, with this podcast, I do, one or two interviews a week, and I interview a lot of artists and people from bands, and I try to listen to as much of their music as I can. And oftentimes I'll feel a little bit burnt out, and I gotta take a break, and I'll just put on whatever I want. You know what I mean? Like, I need a break from the flood. It's almost like metal stops being fun for me at a certain point because I've tried to squeeze in three albums and a demo and an EP and this guy's side project all in one afternoon before I interview him. So I'll take 20 minutes and I'll just put on anything I want, you know, whatever, you know, that my kind of heart, my nostalgic mind just wants to hear. Do you ever get that feeling of being burnt out by metal because you're approaching it in this academic way and just give yourself, like, maybe quote-unquote free listening time or something to that effect?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been burnt out on metal just even before I was an academic, you know? Fortunately for me, like, the amount of time I have to listen to music, like, I can't listen to music and do, like, data analysis. I can edit and, like, do grade entry and stuff like that, so I don't, you know, my listening time is more limited. But yeah, there's other genres I like, sure. I had a big phase in, like, from 2010 to 2020 or so. I was kind of disenchanted with metal, not to, like, throw away the whole decade, but there it was just, despite that Melodeath kind of got me into heavier stuff, it was a key stepping stone for me. I really can't stand it right now, and I feel like Melodeath and kind of that production style that it came with was really dominant in that decade. So I started listening to, like, a whole bunch of rap. there were releases in that time that were great, but I remember, like, you know, oh, okay, metal's going away, that isn't doing much for me right now. So I went in and checked out the other genres I like more. And then in around 2020, especially, 2010, 2020 was that. And then 2020, I think that there's just been this boom of just fantastic music. So I've been listening to mostly, like, 95% metal now because so much good stuff's coming out.
Yeah, I would agree. There's, like, been a whole host of really good releases. But, yeah, certainly I can, sympathize with the experience that, like, Wes is describing. I think especially, like, a lot of us that have gone through the experience in our, like, late teens or, like, early 20s of feeling like, or imposing a kind of, like, self-restriction and, like, only listening to metal and stuff, I think eventually, like, you know, you reach a kind of, like, critical maximum where, like, you know, you just need to step outside of that for a moment. And so I think, like, you know, once I kind of got over the idea that, like, oh, well, I'm a metalhead, I just have to listen to metal, and started kind of branching out and listening to other genres, like, in my early to, you know, later 20s, I've, like, you know, to this day kind of continued to both consume metal, but then also you know, consume other music. Like, more recently, like, I've really enjoyed like Twin Temple and Chelsea Wolfe and Lana Del Rey, which I suppose are all kind of, like, I don't know, they're often, like, acts that are considered, like, metal adjacent, because I guess they kind of share, like, similar, like, dark theming, but are obviously, like, musically speaking, certainly not metal. So I guess, like, I'm stepping outside of metal, but I guess not stepping too far outside of it. I'm more taking a sidestep rather than a complete jump.
Yeah, and, like, the metal people are listening to non-metal, right? So if I want to understand what's going on in metal, like, this is a weird one, but the band Hath, really good. I follow their singer, and one of the guitarists posts funny jokes on Twitter, and I follow them. But he's, like, hugely obsessed with Charlie XCX, is it, or something like that. Anyway, because of that, I was like, all right, well, you know, if this is influencing Hath, I should check it out. And so I listened to all of her albums, and they were all right. I dug it, you know. It was interesting. It's like, okay, there's a lot of good metal, and there are weeks when all I've listened to is metal. But if metal artists are listening to non-metal artists, then if you want to understand metal, you can't stick in the genre. I think being in, like, Japan, for instance, what I really like about Japanese metal is that they have none of these stupid barriers that we put up where it's like, you can only listen to this thing, or, like, black metal has to do this. Like, they don't care, because sometimes they don't know. And then they grew up listening to, you know, entirely different things. Like, they're surrounded by pop music that we never hear, or traditional music that we only hear in, like, movies, right, for, like, 10 seconds. And so they bring those influences in because no one's telling them no. And that's really cool. There's a band called Broken by the Scream, which I wouldn't recommend to anyone because, like, it took me, like, a year of Stockholm Syndrome before I got into it. But I love them, and they combine, like, everyone knows baby metal, but, like, this band combines, like, brutal death metal with, like, pop. And if you can get through it, it's so good. I love them. I just can't recommend them to people because the first time I heard it, I was like, this is unlistenable. And then I kept going back to it. And I was like, why am I still listening to this? And then now I'm like just this diehard fan. But it's cool. And like that would never happen in like the US scene because everyone has this like, you can't put pop into metal. You can't do it. It's not allowed, right? It's they're different genres. And Japan's like, oh, look, we put pop into metal. And sometimes I don't like it. Like, I'm not a huge baby metal fan, but for some reason, when they're like, what about pop with brutal death metal? Would you like that? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. That sounds great. Let's go.
Fair enough. I gotta admit it, that is a hard sell for me, but I am American. Okay, so now here's kind of a. Cause just you're an Australian native. You're from Australia, born and raised, right?
Yeah, born and raised Australia. Yeah.
And Wes, as you said, you're from the Midwest, United States,
I'm from Utah, yeah. Utah.
from Utah.
Spent some time in Minnesota as well, but that kind of area, yeah.
I wanted to get each of your perspectives on well, you mentioned before that like you kind of made a reference to Australian language and cursing, and I mean, Australians kind of have a maybe a stereotype of having a colorful language. It's not something I can relate to being from Long Island here on the East Coast and of the United States. Kind of a working class, but there's also like there's different words. I just wanted to get each of your perspectives on that, why that might be, and maybe like Jess growing up in that culture, like your perspective on that, and then Wes, as someone approaching language academically and immersing yourself in a different country, your perspective on that.
So in terms of like why that variation exists, or
Why, yeah, what, well, what, yeah, why is there this uniquely this unique perception of Australians as cursing a lot and having particularly foul language very casually. Is that true? Is there a reason for that?
yeah, okay, so that's a good question, but a big question. I'd say that one way we could answer this is based on the kind of like narrative around like Australian identity that's connected to like convict origins and stuff. So particularly like obviously after like European like invasion colonization of Australia, Australia became a penal colony, and so a lot of the first like white people that came to Australia were convicts, and because of that, there is this kind of like narrative around Australian identity as being kind of like from these like convict roots. And that's, obviously has an association with like vulgarity as well then. Certainly not every Australian actually has convict roots. It's actually relatively rare, but the like narrative, or at least the idea of us kind of like coming from like convict roots, at least, the like white settlers coming from convict roots, is a really big one here. I'd say the other one has to do with like, our national identity that's often perceived as being like very kind of like laid back, very jovial. And so swearing in everyday life is a way of kind of communicating that value that, that none of us are taking ourselves like too seriously, that we're always kind of like joking around, and that, we prefer like egalitarianism over like social hierarchy. Again, that's not necessarily to say that there's no social hierarchy like or class in Australia. There certainly is, but at least like on a kind of like ideological kind of values-based level, Australians do tend to say though that we're like a country that's based on the ideas of kind of like mateship and egalitarianism, like everyone kind of being on the same level and that kind of thing. And that's reflected, I think, in like a lot of prolific swearing, because people will swear in situations that, like Wes was kind of alluding to like earlier, in hypothetical communication with the Prime Minister or something like that, you could potentially swear, right? Like, so we're swearing in situations where like a lot of people in other cultural contexts probably wouldn't. And I think that's in part kind of manifesting those ideas around what it is to be Australian, which is still very much like contested. There's certainly no kind of uniform idea of like what it is to be Australian, and that's made especially complicated by the fact that like the Australian identity is a colonial one in some ways.
Okay, thank you for
So does
that. No,
that
I and I and I, I realized I did ask a big open-ended question that you know requires a great deal of historical context. So I do appreciate that. And again, I'm learning here. I appreciate it. So Wes, if you want to give your take.
Yeah. So I grew up a bit of a swearer. Like, and in retrospect, I think it was very much pushing back. Again, I didn't like where I grew up in a safe, friendly place, but it was very, very religious, and I had issues with, like, you know, the way things were. Part of my identity was pushing back against that, and so I think I swore a bunch, kind of, to, like, you know. I don't align with things. But that said, I was also like a quote unquote good kid in some ways. Like, I got good grades. I wanted to be a teacher's pet thing. So, like, I didn't like swear to teachers, or I didn't go. So there's like a balance that in retrospect, I was always kind of doing between, again, types of identities and swearing. And as I got older, like swearing just to swear or to be a swearer, and meeting people who swore a lot that I didn't like, is like, oh, I don't want to align with them, right? I probably reduced my swearing a lot. But even then, coming to Australia, there have been things that surprised me. Like, I never used the word cunt, and I've been called, like, you know, that's Wes, he's a good cunt. And it's like, what? Okay. You know, or having someone to be like, hey, how's it going, cunt? And then it's like, are we fighting? No, we're not fighting. You're greeting me. Okay, got it. Like, you know, that kind of thing is a bit of a whiplash, but I work at a university. It's not like that's a greeting that you see here. You know, there's still, like, you know, places where swearing happens less, but you do hear it, and you do a lot more for sure. There's still times, even after a decade now in Australia, where someone will even just use a non-swearing word, a normal word. I'll have to be like, I have no idea what that means. And guessing from context,
happens semi-regularly.
Yeah. Could you, help me out here? Like, even a small one, I was sending up a meeting for someone. They said, let's meet at midday. And to me, at least in my version of American accent, midday is anywhere from like 11:30 to like 2. And so it's like, okay, when? And like midday. I'm like, right. When midday? And they're like, midday. I'm like, okay, hey, yeah. I'm going to guess, is midday noon in this country by chance? And like, yes. And then we kind of had a laugh about it. But they were clearly getting very frustrated with me because I think they thought I was just like illiterate.
That's interesting, and it's funny because the word you the C word, I'm no prude when it comes to cursing, you know, shit, fuck, whatever, all this shit. But I'll admit that was a word that I didn't even use in this questioning or bring up in that line of questioning because of how I was born and raised here and where I'm from. It would be so utterly disrespectful for me to say that word with Jess present, and that's just my my upbringing. It's just like a mental ingrained thing, and my parents cursed growing up, but that word is just something over here you really don't say, or you reserve for the most vile of situations. And the idea that it's such a common word over there in Australia, that's always been, I mean, that's obviously funny to a lot of people in bigger culture, but I just wanted to point that out. It is funny, and I, you know, it's worth noting in this conversation.
I still don't use it very much. Like, yeah. I haven't adopted it, but I'm guessing that Jess has called me a cunt at least once as a friendly gesture.
Yeah, many times. I mean,
probably under the influence of alcohol, but
yeah, but like, that's the thing. Like, I think that cunt here, like, can have like a non-pejorative meaning. Like, in fact, it can be used in like a context of extending solidarity. So, I think that's part of the reason why we use it like so commonly. But like, I have used it in, like, when I went to America for the first time, I did, like, I was like staying with like some frat guys like near University of New Brunswick. Wow. And like, I thought, like, this is, if there's anywhere in America where I can use cunt, this will be fine, right? And I just like threw it out there like pretty casually, and like, yeah, the looks I got, I was like, oh, okay, this is like definitely one to kind of like keep under wraps. Maybe don't use that in public.
and before someone listens to this podcast and comes to Australia and starts calling everyone cunt, like, there are, it is contextual. Like, if a student walked into class, my class, and said, hey, good morning, cunt, I'd be like, out, you know, no way. Yeah. That's not flying. Like, no matter how friendly you mean that, that's not happening in like a, you know, a university classroom setting. But if I went and visited Jess and she's like, oh, good to see you, cunt, I'd be like, okay, I accept this. That's fine, I guess.
At the pub or something like that. That's
It's all very interesting to me. Is there a word that is more like, you know, maybe a swear word or some sort of vulgar word that's more common in the United States here that is considered very offensive over, or is there a word in general that is like a no-go in Australian, you know, culture?
Besides like, you know, racist, sexist, homophobic.
I'm not trying to go there.
Yeah. Look, Australians say fuck a lot too, but we have interviewed Australians who treat fuck as like an American swear word. Like Americans use fuck too much.
That's funny.
Is a stereotype that we've definitely encountered. Like,
for sure.
Yeah, I didn't want to use fuck too much because it would sound like I'm trying to be like American or something. We've heard that.
Wow, that is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
We do. It's not a stereotype for some. Well, maybe I'm proving the stereotype true, man. Because that is, I mean, yeah, that fucking shit are kind of like our go-to. That, I mean, those might as well just be like, you know, just like common everyday nouns or something, you know. Okay, so I appreciate your time. You've been very generous with your time. I just have you know, one or two more questions about music, maybe, and your perception of lyrics and music. I want to talk about other genres of harder music. You know, I don't know how much either of you get into hardcore, punk, but, you know, metalcore, things that have maybe a more like quote unquote street level narrative, talking about social situations, things that are right in front of you, as opposed to metal. We touched on this when you guys interviewed me, the grandiosity of metal, so to speak, and the more romantic notions of metal. I don't know if maybe you could compare and contrast just a little bit. Is there, first of all, are either of you, you know, fans of that type of music? Do you follow those lyrics as you would follow metal lyrics? And is there something to be noted about the difference in narrative between the styles of music?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's any genre of music that I don't like at least one or two artists of. I mean, obviously they have preferences. So, but yeah, I listen to some more hardcore stuff. I think one thing that I've had trouble unpacking is like how much the actual form of the music impacts the kind of language that's being used, because a lot of hardcore stuff, it's a very, you know, there's like the kind of staccato beats to it. Like, we interviewed Terminal Nation a while back, and they've had a very hardcore influence on the kind of death metal they do. It's like a death metal hardcore kind of mix, and it seems like when the music has that beat, they try to, people avoid longer words, like it's much shorter, you know, punchy phrasing. And I don't know if that's like, part of it, I guess, is again those genre differences. Like, okay, we're a hardcore band, we do hardcore style, or we're a death metal band, we need bigger words. But also, like, just the fact that the phrases, like the verses, the choruses, they're faster. The beats, like the guitars, don't like go gurn and kind of hold. You know, it's all going. That I think maybe impacts how you can actually, if the vocals aren't matching the music. So can you fit like an 8-syllable word in there? I don't know. Yeah, just you. We've definitely interviewed some of these bands.
Yeah, sure. I think those are the kind of like major differences in terms of like the like composition. I suppose the other difference that comes to mind is just, I suppose, in terms of style of language. In that, like, a lot of the metal bands that we've interviewed typically use like that more kind of like literary style that you would see in, you know, like literary texts. Whereas I think a lot of the language that I've seen, at least me personally, that I've seen in like hardcore, especially punk, seems to be a lot more aligned to like that kind of conversational style of English. As an example, like not trying to bring everything back to the Australian context, but like one of the things we've seen with a lot of like Australian metal lyrics is that there's nothing really Australian about them. Like in terms of like the actual language that they use, they're not really using a lot of like Australian English. Conversely, like punk and like pub rock bands here typically do use a lot more Australian English. So like one of my favorite like punk, like pub rock bands here is Amel and the Sniffers. And they like not only like sing using an Australian accent, but they also use a lot of like Australian English in their lyrics as well. And that's, yeah, obviously not something we typically see in Australian metal lyrics. So I think that distinction between like using like everyday language in like genres like punk versus using more kind of like erudite kind of literary language in metal is a kind of genre division that I've seen quite a bit.
Yeah, we interviewed a friend of ours, Loki, from the band Hybrid Nightmares, specifically like mentioned a punk band in Australia who have a song called Vomit, where they like talk about just drinking too much and then vomiting in various places. And it ends with, I'm going to lose my fucking job. And like he specifically raised that as you would never hear that in an Australian like extreme metal lyric. But it's absolutely okay in an Australian punk context.
Okay. Again, like I'm, you guys are kind of teaching me things about myself here, with the different bands I've been and thinking about my, you know, the reasons why I choose my own words. I do appreciate this conversation, and I wasn't even thinking of it in terms of song structure and how many, you know, the words and the syllables you can fit into the song, but obviously that makes a lot of sense. Definitely appreciate that. So now, like I said, I appreciate your time. You've been very generous with your time. We haven't really even gotten into your book. You're both published authors in your own right, aside from the team. That's correct, right? Could you please just maybe take a minute, just for the sake of the listeners and myself, and just talk about your own work and the collaboration that you know you've done together for in the context of Lingua Britannica.
Actually, that works really well because it was doing our own work that got us to collaborate. So I guess it's all linked. So I'll go back. We met at a conference for PhD students that was held at our university because Jess had a behemoth patch. Was it a patch or
A satchel, behemoth satchel,
satchel? Yeah, a behemoth satchel. It was like cool behemoth satchel, and we started chatting, and then we ran into each other, and I think it was it Guar?
Guar Satyricon.
Yeah, Guar Satyricon, a totally normal combination of bands to have a show together. And we just started hanging out, and obviously we're both into linguistics, we're both into metal, but we weren't in metal studies. We never thought we were going to do like a linguistics of metal or anything like that. My traditional focus has been on Japanese and specifically variation in the Japanese writing system. Like we've been talking about like accent or if you swear, and I've been looking at like I guess an English equivalent would be like, why do you type in all caps, right? You can vary the way you, why do you use this font? Like, why do you write in Comic Sans? I've looked at stuff like that, but in the Japanese context. And Spotify randomly flagged me under this band called Gotsutotsukotsu, which is a Japanese death metal band. Really sick, really good stuff. And I, yeah, shout out to them because without them, this entire thing wouldn't exist. So got to give them a little listen to them, give them those Spotify listens. It'll give them a tenth of a cup of coffee every year. And they played with the writing system. So I screenshotted that and sent it to Jess. I was like, hey, should I do a paper on, Japanese metal like typography? And she's like, Thonic does stuff like that too. Maybe we should collaborate on it. And I was like, yeah, okay, that sounds sick. And so we started to bounce ideas back together, and we sent out interview requests to both these bands, and they said yes, which was, especially in Thonic's situation, surprising.
Amazing. Yeah, considering, yeah, Freddie Lim is also a politician in Taiwan.
Like Thonic, I mean, given the size of Thonic and the fact that he has like a politician job, it was a Hail Mary. But that anyway, it was great, and it gave us the confidence to eventually, for this podcast, just the Hail Mary interview everyone. And like 80% of the emails we send out get completely ignored, but when they don't, we get interviews with people like you or Cynic or all these great bands that have talked to us. So why not? It can't hurt. Sending an email, it can't hurt, right? But yeah, we worked on a paper together, and it got published in a journal that we'd both been individually rejected by, which is so by our powers combined, right? We're like, okay, yeah, we can do something. And also we felt that there was more to say. Like the paper got good reviews from the peer review process. So we said, all right, let's send some more interviews out. And we interviewed people in Australia for the podcast. The podcast came kind of separately, but we're like, hey, we got these Australian interviews. Why not put Australia in there? I interviewed a bunch of bands in Japan. Jess interviewed a bunch of bands in Taiwan and Indonesia. And we kind of took the what we started with that paper and just expanded it into a whole book, which hopefully will be coming out maybe late this year, if not early next year. Like the
Fingers
publisher's
crossed,
keen.
yeah.
Yeah, we've passed the publisher's peer review. We haven't signed a contract yet, so it's not 100%, but like everything's moving smoothly at the moment. So hopefully, look out for peripheral linguistic brutality in bookstores near you or on the internet.
Peripheral linguistic brutality.
Yeah, it's kind of a Dimmu Borgir shout out, right? Puritanical euphoric misanthropia.
I like it. I love you. You know, I like lyrical homages to other lyrics, things like that.
There's a chapter heading called "All You Gilded Cunts," which is about swearing in Australia. So I'm proud of that one. Yeah, that was good coming up with that.
There's,
one.
Yeah, this if you like lyrical homage, then this is the book for you.
Great, bring it on. And also what you said before about the Hail Mary emails for guests for your podcast. I've been there because my rest in peace to Steve Grimmett of the band Grim Reaper. I interviewed him very early on in my own podcast history. And I think I sent the guy a Facebook message after watching a video of him performing on YouTube. And the guy got right back to me. Was so cool. Wow. My engineer and I made a mistake and didn't like something went wrong with the recording and we had to redo the interview and he was still really cool. I mean, Steve Grimmett, I rest in peace to that man. Always just kind of gave me the confidence to reach out to anyone. If I actually revealed some of the people I've reached out to who haven't gotten back to me, you might laugh, but that's for another time. One more question, really. I again, I'm very appreciative of how generous you've been with your time. One more question before I ask you to recommend some music you've been listening to lately. Bands with different, even this shows how maybe egocentric or in a bubble my own perception is because of what I'm about to say. I find it difficult to listen to bands that write their lyrics in a different language than English. Respect to those bands, respectfully. And that sounds funny because I'm talking about death metal where 90% of the time you can't understand it anyway. But there's like a mental block for me there where if I don't understand exactly what the song titles are alluding to and the aesthetic of the band is, it just doesn't catch my interest as much. And I'm not trying to say that to put any band down who speaks in another language. I know how like stereotypical American that makes me sound. And in a bubble, it's like a little flaw as a listener or something, man, that I should work on. I wanted to get your take on that, if that's how you feel about bands that maybe write their lyrics in a language that you don't understand or haven't ever researched. Does that affect your listening to it? Or what's your take on that notion?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the majority of, I mean, it's an interesting question because I think like when I think back on it, like the majority of metal that I listen to is written in languages that I can understand, at least even if I'm not like totally fluent in it, as is the case with, you know, Taiwanese and Chinese languages. But that being said, I certainly have listened to metal music in languages that I don't understand. And I think in that case, if the music is something that I just generally enjoy, I can still like get into it even if I can't access the lyrical content. And sometimes like, you know, you can still hear like some of the like the melody as well, even though it's written in a language that like I can't understand. I mean, a lot of Japanese metal, obviously I don't speak Japanese. So like that's one that I can appreciate even if I don't understand it. And I guess one of the benefits of listening to music in a language that you don't understand is that you can just like enjoy the sounds without like kind of like focusing on like trying to parse like what's being said, which I think in some cases can just be like a nice little like relief. It's kind of relaxing. You can just like, you know, like all vibes, no brain, like just engage.
Initially I want to be like, no, just listen to music in languages that you don't know. It's fine. But when I think about it, like, what's the number one non-English language I listen to music in? Japanese. And other than that, like, I don't understand what they're saying when they're saying it. Cause like your music, I love, I'm not just saying that because we're on the podcast. I love your last album, the Afterbirth album. It's great. I had no idea what your lyrics were before we looked them up. Like, I cannot like pierce a single like word, right? Because the way you perform it, and so that should be true. Like it shouldn't matter, but I do find myself gravitating to languages I speak. That said, through this project and through kind of listening to more and more bands, I've started to kind of embrace like not understanding and being okay with it, and that's led me to some really exciting music. So, I mean, metal's an acquired taste, right? So the next step is metal, where the sounds of the language, the sounds that they're making with their mouths aren't ones that you're used to. That's like an exciting, if you think of it like as an exciting frontier that might take you some time to get into, you really open the door to a lot of really cool stuff. Like Jess has shown me a bunch of, you know, bands from Indonesia, Taiwan, etc. In this podcast, we had the opportunity to interview a band from China called O. And like, I know for our interview, we looked up what they were saying and translated it, right? But I've forgotten. I didn't memorize, you know, but I still listen to them just because like the sounds that they're making are so cool. We've interviewed some Italian bands, and again, for the podcast, we do the research, but I don't remember what they're saying. I still like the music though. So yeah, I don't know. I get the hesitation. I understand it, and I think it is in me, even as I am someone that now tries to listen to international stuff. But if you can get past it, to anyone who's listening to this, like there's so much really cool metal being made around the globe that it's worth the effort to get into the vocals, and start with, you know, start with the really, really extreme stuff where it's screamed, because then it doesn't matter as much. It took me a long time to get into like Japanese power metal, where I was just like, oh my God, especially when they like when they have English lyrics and the pronunciation is just very different from how I would pronounce it, right? It doesn't matter because they're hitting the notes. They're on key, but like that's not where I would put the emphasis. What's going on here? But now that I've, you know, I got past some of that, and there's some albums by some Japanese bands that don't sing in the guttural stuff that I actually really, really dig, because I kind of worked through that little block I had. You know, props to them. I've never released an album in Japanese, and they're releasing albums in English. Takes a lot of confidence. Good on them, you know. Rock it.
Yeah, fair enough. And again, I say that, you know, I asked that question respectfully, and I said what I said respectfully. You know, I've struggled with other languages throughout my life, so I see that as more of a flaw in myself, not you know, to put down any other band out there. So, with that all being said, then, Lingua Brutalica podcast, if I'm not mistaken, Podbean is the platform you put forth most frequently, but it's available on all the usual platforms, right?
Yeah, all the
Spotify,
usual platforms.
and we have a YouTube account which is like our least active. We update it like Podbean and Spotify is both at the same time. YouTube tends to happen later, but some people apparently really like listening to podcasts on YouTube, so we do try to, you
And it
know,
is
and we
up
get
to date
some,
now, so yeah.
yeah, and we get some really nice comments. Like we've got some of the nicest comments ever on YouTube. So, yeah, it's really cool to have a place where people can, you know, say like, hey, this is like our Panopticon interview has like a bunch of people saying like, oh man, I really love the lyrics of this band. Thank you for like and talking about some of their own personal connections to what that band has done. And it's really cool to see people engaging with like we're a podcast about the sociolinguistics of death metal. Like when we started this, we thought like maybe four people on the planet would check us out, you know? Because it's such a niche. It's a double niche, right? Like you got to get the metal fans, but then we exclude the metal fans that don't care about lyrics, right? And we're trying to get the linguists, but like the number of linguists that like death metal is well, I know two.
Yeah.
But yeah, hearing people actually vibe with it is great. And even hearing artists say that they've, you know, gotten something out of the chats we've had gives a lot of motivation, because there's a lot, it's a lot of work to do these.
Yeah.
So knowing that people care, and that the people that do it, the people that come on, that are, they're so kind to answer our random emails and give us their time, find it a beneficial process, puts a lot of motivation to keep going.
Yeah, well, just on what you said there, about, you know, not knowing how many, you know, how much of a listenership you would have, you know, based on it being a niche, I would actually counter that with, because of what you do, it has a broader listenership. Because something I've encountered, I'm not going to call anyone out specifically, and I'm not going to act like I'm the best there is or anything, but something that inspired me to do this podcast is, a lot of times you'll look up an artist you want to, you know, interview with, whoever, and it's somebody who maybe is inexperienced or didn't take a lot of time to do their research. And they're asking the most kind of base level generic questions. They don't even know about, you know, maybe an artist's, you know, full catalog or something like that. You know, so the attention to research that you do with Lingua Brutalica, it transcends just the idea of language. You know, the idea that you're breaking down all these facts about the lyrics, like we said, you know, when you interviewed me, I tried to make the point that lyrics can be so much. You know, I mentioned Earth Crisis being like a vegan social activism band, and then there's National Socialist black metal. Without their lyrics, you know, what are they, and that sort of thing. It's like lyrics can be almost everything of a band, in some cases, and not just those two extremes. But I just bring those up to make a point. So you're tapping into maybe the essence of what metal can be to a lot of people, and why we relate to it when you break down the lyrics. And also, I just think in general, from what I've seen from the feedback of the listenership of the Heavy Hole podcast, and I'm very thankful for the people who are regular listeners. People appreciate it when you go in deep on metal and treat it as a proper subculture with a history and lore and stories all to itself. People like to know what kind of a guitar somebody plays. They like to know things like that. But more importantly, I think people like to have that human connection and to know the story, you know, just like we have, we have very in-depth documentaries on rock and roll, on hip hop, on pop musicians. People who like metal have that same interest in our favorite artists. And if you can bring that to people in underground death metal are starved for that, because we don't have those regular outlets, because our music isn't as popularly supported in commercial markets. So that's all I would say. And I think that's the appeal. And on that note, I'm going to encourage all of my listeners from Heavy Hole podcast to check out Lingua Brutalica podcast. Even if you're tired of listening to me talk, there's 51 other episodes. There's people with all sorts of different accents, not just Long Island accents. It's definitely worth a deep dive. Like I said, there's a lot of episodes. I tried to listen to several, and you mentioned Panopticon. I listened to that Panopticon one today on my commute. I found it very interesting. And the way he
got we were shocked that one was we were shocked that came about. That was like that was just serendipitous, because we interviewed Nechachwin and he had a good time, and we're like, hey, you know, you did an EP with Panopticon. Can we,
could you carry some favor? Yeah.
Can you carry some favor? And he's like, sure. And then all of a sudden we get an email, and it's like, oh my gosh. Yeah. It's amazing that some people will just say yes, even with a little bit of luck. And then of course some people will never contact us, and that's, you know, get back to us.
That's fine.
That's fine too. Yeah.
I average a lot of people not getting back to me. It's fine. You know, you got some numbers game. You just got to keep sending out the messages.
Ain't that it? It's totally a shotgun thing, isn't it? Like you just send it out and you hope. And we've had people I'd say 75% or so just don't even get back to us. The people that get back to us, some of them are no's, right? So even then it's like the results are low. And then every once in a while, someone won't get back to us. And then 5 months later, they're like, hey, I found this email. I'll do it. And it's like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. It was a twist.
So you never know.
Twist of fate.
If anyone wants to be interviewed by us, by the way, as long as you are not an NSBM band, send us an email and we'd love to save us some time. That'd be great.
Yeah, I bring that example up as an extreme example of the role lyrics, you know, can play in a band.
I think it's a great example. I think it's a great question, right? Like what is NSBM without the lyrics? Because that, I mean, I guess it's the posturing and the clothing and the stuff they put on stage, right? And the horrible symbols.
Everything
and the artwork
surrounds
but still, like it's a good point. Like lyrics are super important to metal, and perhaps one of the worst parts of metal is a great example of it, because the whole thing of their metal is producing this message, right, through language. So it's an awful part of our scene. But you're right. It's a key example of how language can be a really vital part of the art, because the art that they want to produce has a vile message, and the lyrics are definitely part of that vile message, right?
Absolutely. And worth educating yourself on, I'll just say. Just because something is a dark topic or something you don't agree with, we should all try to maintain awareness and education. I'll just leave it at that. And with that being said, on a lighter note, I'd like to thank both of you once again for your time. This has been a great Friday evening for me, a tedious Saturday morning for both of you.
Not tedious at all.
No, wonderfully engaging Saturday morning.
I'm joking. So, but I am going to ask you now, as I ask all my guests, if each of you could take a turn recommending an older and a newer release of music, metal or otherwise, no specific rules about the date, just something from back in the day and something a little bit more recent.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think if I go first, my back in the day. Okay. So, I've got to go with, from back in the day, these are just albums that I think were really pivotal in my metal journey. The bands themselves might be considered a bit problematic, but I think
Satyricon's now diabolical album and Dimmu Borgir's puritanic euphoric misanthropia, I think those two in particular were really like foundational to like my enjoyment of the genre. And I think they've really framed for me what I consider to be like good lyrics and good music, at least initially. And I think, you know, obviously it expanded my kind of palette since then. But yeah, those two albums, I think from back in the day, were really, really big for me. More recently, I think some of my favorite releases from the last year or so, probably one from Hellrippers, Warlocks, Grim and Withered Hags was a huge one. I love that album. Yeah, listen to it to be transported to the Scottish Highlands, you know, getting into the mythology, even got a bit of like Scottish language in there. Just love it. Amazing. Cattle Decaps, Terracite, also very strong. I loved it. And yeah, they also put on an amazing show here in Australia pretty recently. And final one. Oh, yeah, I should also mention, because I was listening to it just the other day, With Indestruction's Rebirth, I think I really enjoyed too, just all from the last year.
All right, solid, solid. Within Destruction, what do you remember offhand what country they're from?
Yeah, they're so
Eastern Europe.
Within Destruction,
somewhere?
Is it Switzerland? I want to say.
Okay, all right, because I am.
I think is that right? Slovenia, Slovenia.
It's
Slovenia.
Yeah. Because I wanted to make sure it was the right band. I met those guys. I did a short stint filling in for Pyrexia several years ago on vocals, and they were doing tour support on that same tour. Nice guys, good guys. Very. They had like a really, the whole drum kit was like electronic kind of drum pad stuff and samples, and they were like very high tech and ahead of their time. They were really interesting band, and they had their whole kit together live. Really, really good. I don't know if you've ever seen them live, but
yeah, they were here last year before. Yeah,
it's been
amazing.
Been several years since I've seen them live. Interesting band. All right, so Wes, you want to take a stab at that one?
Yeah, old stuff. So like I said, I started with like nu metal and things like that. So I don't have any old recommendations that aren't like really, really well known. But I guess, yeah, as I mentioned, Cradle of Filth's Midian was defining for me. And I still go back and listen to it. I think like Ministry's The Mind is a Terrible Thing to Taste was also a real eye opener. And like Meshuggah's maybe like a Nothing and Chaos Sphere were also really, really influential to me. So like those are not under like unknown albums at all, but great stuff that I find really important to my enjoyment and getting into metal. For more recent stuff, everything Jess said I love as well. I'll try to do like kind of a bit more obscure things. There was an album in 2022 by a band called Miscreants, which I believe is Italian or something, and that just loved it. I really love what's been happening in the last few years with kind of a revival of the sort of a somewhat proggy death sound, like the sound that Death had in their last three or four albums. Stuff like Atheist, not full on tech death, which I do like, but that kind of still had the rawness of death metal, but a little bit of breathing room. Some bands have been like Phobophilic does a really good job with it.
Yes,
kind of bringing that back, but using a bit more modern techniques and production. And Miscreants' album was just amazing. It totally scratched that itch for me. And then I've recommended a bunch of Japanese stuff, but one band that blows me away that I'm really, really excited about is Kokeshi. They're like a black gaze band. And they have two albums out. And their first album especially, like it has no reason. Like a first album by a band should not be that good. I'm not going to say it's like the best album I've ever heard or like flawless, but a band should not be able to produce an album that good for their first album. And the singer is this Japanese woman, and she just has this range of everything from like the most brutal screams, like growls, to these high-pitched screams, to this like spoken word stuff she does. And it's really, the stuff that they're doing is really cool. It's really innovative. A bigger band in the same band would be like Asa no Joke, which is again kind of a Japanese black gaze, but they're way more popular. The experimenting with things, the ability to experiment because the restrictions aren't there is really cool, and Kokeshi's doing a great job. So if you dig black metal that's a bit more not Cobalt or whatever, a bit more try to mesh genres. Really great stuff. Yeah, highly recommended.
All right. Fair enough, man. A lot there. What you were saying before about Miscreants from Italy was the band, right?
I think they're from Italy, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because you talk about Phobophilic, and this kind of like newer wave of more progressive death metal that, like, I don't know if you've I don't know if you're a Tumult fan,
Oh yeah.
but I my band Afterbirth, we got to perform a show with them this past Friday. They were amazing live. Really great band to catch live if you ever have the opportunity.
Oh yeah. We'd love to interview Tumult.
Yeah.
They can check
That'd
their
be dope.
email if they'd like to. Yeah.
You guys are gonna come highly recommended, man. Maybe I'll drop them a little message, man. Yeah, nice guys, Tumult, and obviously exceptional band. I think most people listening to this are aware of that now. But more importantly, thank you to both of you for your time. I really appreciate this conversation as much as I appreciated being on your podcast, Lingua Brutalica podcast. One more time for my listeners, I encourage them to check out your podcast, check out all the music that we discussed as well. Hopefully they were taking notes throughout the course of this. I'm just going to give each of you a minute. I don't know if you have your own, besides Lingua Brutalica, if you have your own websites to promote your books or anything else you want to plug and promote, if you just want to take a minute here, and go ahead.
Well, so the book, Peripheral Linguistic Brutality, we don't have a date, but hopefully, assuming some kind of disaster doesn't happen, knock on wood, it should be out end of this year or sometime next year. So if you're keen about learning more about language use in metal in the Asia Pacific, please check it out when it's out. Beyond that, I have a blog called Scripting Japan where I do analysis of Japanese slang, weird things about the Japanese language. So if by chance you're a heavy hole listener who likes Japanese education, or weird facts about Japanese, check it out. That'd be great.
I'm sure there's a Venn diagram for the Japanese language and the heavy hole. The trust me.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to jump in.
No. That's good point. Similarly, obviously, you can look out for the book when that's out. For updates on any of my work, you can go to my website if you have interest in doing so. That's drjesscrook.wordpress.com.
Okay, Dr. Jess Crook and Dr. Wes Robertson, again, thank you so much for your time. Any parting words for listeners of your podcast or listeners of my podcast?
Thanks for the stay metal. Thanks for being part. Look, it's a cool community to be part of, and we're honored to have people listen to what we say and come on and answer our questions. So, yeah, I feel more like a metalhead now than I kind of ever have now that I through this podcast, this research. What do you think, Jess?
Yeah, I'd say the same, and I suppose that's the suggestion that I always make to people, both inside and outside the scene. It's like, don't dismiss lyrics. I think lyrics, especially in heavy metal, are some of the most interesting, the most rich, and ultimately quite thought-provoking that I've personally ever engaged with. So one of the wonderful things about metal is that if you scratch the surface, like if you dig deeper, there's always something else to find. And I think that lyrics are one of the great kind of pathways to doing that.
Yeah, I think metal at its best can be like is a place where a lot of really warm, welcoming, passionate people are going above and beyond like 100%. And it's really cool to have a place like that, in the world where people value effort and community that is sometimes a bit weird, a space for weird people like us who want to do a podcast focused on analyzing metal lyrics.
Yeah.
I can relate. And we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, man. that was that we appreciate very much the time of our esteemed colleagues, Dr. Jess Crook and Dr. Wes Robertson of Lingua Brutalica podcast. I think you got enough information about it just now, but of course, check them out on social media, on YouTube, wherever you listen to podcasts. As you realize by now, you can listen to a whole episode where I talked about my lyrics. If you don't get enough of my voice and my self-indulgence about me talking about my bands all the time. By the way, speaking of me, there's another person helping me tonight with this podcast. Ian, you still with me?
Absolutely.
Or I didn't even mean to say me that last time. It just popped out. That's how pig-headed I am. Ian, enough. I want to let you talk a little bit. Do you feel like taking the gentleman's lead tonight with the recommendations?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's talk about a band that doesn't involve me for a minute, please.
Can do. So
No, not that one. Not that one. I'm sorry. All right. It was a joke about a band I got kicked out of. All right. Go ahead.
All right. Perfect. So, my recommendation for today is a new debut LP coming off the back of an Indonesian-based death metal outfit called Nocturnal. It's Nocturnal spelled N-O-K and then Turnal. Mm. This is a new album that's dropping off Pulverized Records, and it's going to be out on May 3rd of 2024, and the name of the album is Shades of Night. I just thought this one was interesting. There's only one track streaming as of this recording, and it's called Dagger of Will. In looking at the timestamp on this one, it's a lengthy song. As far as death metal is concerned, it's between 6 and 7 minutes long. If you look at all 6 tracks on the album, all of them kind of sit in that sweet spot between 5 and 7 minutes long. So I'm interested to hear the others. Really quick, some things about this record. There is a solo on this Dagger of Will track that comes courtesy of Junz, J-U-N-G-S, who is from Indonesian thrash band Head Crusher. It's all one word, spelt with a K on Crusher.
They should do a split with Head Bussa, the hardcore band.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
That would be awesome. They are actually cool. So if you get around to checking out Head Crusher too, it's worthwhile. And then also, there's a synth guest spot, which I've yet to listen to because it's on a song that's not yet released. And that's coming from the guitarist of AK-47, which is a grindcore band also based out of Indonesia. So if you're interested in some of the features, those are the two that I saw. Other than that, I mean, like I said, it's a long song. I think that it kept my attention the whole time because it kind of ran in and out of a lot of like more mid-tempo stuff, and then a lot of the busier riffage, not blasting, but some quick moving shit as well. If I had to pick like a four fans of, it was tough. I don't really have a good one. I would say maybe Tribulation, but I don't really hear any like gothic elements on this at all yet. So if you like Tribulation's black metal-ness, but with a little bit more of like a palatable like rock bass, I don't know. I think that there's an element of that here. So that's everything on my end. Will, if you got a chance to listen to it, open to hear your thoughts on this guy here from Nocturnal.
Yeah, not familiar with the band before you sent me this song. Very glad that you sent me this song. Interesting that they got the guest synth spot from the guitarist of the grindcore band. It's usually like, you know, your symphonic metal guy over here. Hey, buddy, can you help me out? You know that, or the producer. But the guitarist of the grindcore band kind of, you know, spreading his wings a little bit. I like that. But the song is somewhat long by depending on your standards, but it doesn't there goes a lot of places, but it doesn't feel as long as it is, if that makes sense. I thought in the beginning few riffs, it kind of starts off, I don't want to say predictably, that's not the word. It starts off in familiar territory. It started off the first few riffs of the song. I'm thinking, just to give the listeners a frame of reference, maybe Altars of Madness, maybe old school Sepultura, maybe even a little Monstrosity there, just that kind of classic death metal, of that certain generation. A little bit of that. I'm not saying it sounds exactly like any of that, but, it definitely feels like familiar territory, and it kind of gradually unfurls with, like, these. And it's interesting. It kind of clicks now that you mentioned that some of the guitar work was a guest thing, too, because it's really impassioned, not showing off, not, you know, not showboating, but definitely, you know, the idea that it's a guest, he wants to make his impact. It's very, you know, well thought out and impactful. Impactful is the word. The lead guitar work on this track, the way that it kind of, again, the beginning is not simple. It's not monotonous. It's not bad that it reminded me of those bands. And then it got a little bit more complicated and atmospheric. It's like I said, it kind of starts off in familiar territory and gradually takes you out of bounds into, some dissonance, some melodic qualities, but maybe in a more like forlorn, doomish kind of way, not melodic, like the, you know, the Swedish shiny death metal stuff. It's, I want to say that this is kind of like your Blackened Death or your black metal that has a lot of respect for that old school era of early death metal and evil thrash metal, and they kind of take it and do their own thing with it. This is also a little bit like, I'm a little bit, you know, over my head with this territory of metal to begin with, you know, the black metal and Blackened Death. I dip my toes in that, but it's not really my, you know, my usual wheelhouse. So I'm just going to leave it there. This is a great song that you recommended for me. I will check out the album. And I would just say this, if you're maybe like me from the more gore grind death metal hip hop area, and you kind of dip your toes in black metal and Blackened Death, this is really interesting. This is something that, kept my attention, and, everything just felt inspired. I don't want to use the word catchy, but there, you know, it is a pleasure to listen to. There's no filler in this song. That's what I'll say. There's no filler, and it's very impactful. That's the two things I want to leave you with. Any final thoughts, Ian?
No, that was great.
Yeah, and just do me. Let's tell Tom. Remind Tom again what the band and the song is, and the it's on Pulverized Records.
Correct. Yeah, Pulverized Records. The artist is Nocturnal. The album is Shades of Night. And the track is Dagger of Will.
Didn't even make a Dagger of Will, Big Will. I didn't even do that. I'm trying to calm my ego down. So as I try to refrain from flexing and making it all about me and my tape collection, I recommended to you, Ian, the Person Inside of Reagan demo tape. This is from 1997. I'm holding my original copy, that I have in my tape collection. I'm just showing off for the listeners again, man. It's all a joke. I know I'm coming off here as a certain kind of elitist, but listen, this band is very interesting. There are pseudonyms, black metal style pseudonyms. Reagan McNeil and Captain Howdy were the members of this band, allegedly. A band featuring Ray Rivera, who is, I believe, still active in the underground scene and responsible for various other projects, including Chupacabra, one of my favorite bands, also from that era that did a split with Anal Birth back in the 90s. But this Person Inside of Reagan demo, you can find, apparently it was released on 7-inch format a few years ago, and I was able to find it on YouTube to recommend to you. I don't know if the 7-inch is still available. I kind of got to look that up. I would love to have that as well. But this is an easy 11-minute or so listen. It says contact subhumanoid6@yahoo.com for the 7-inch, just if you're interested in that. Or you can go to the Joaba YouTube channel. To check out this Person Inside a Reagan demo. But what's the music like? Obviously, you might have caught on by now that it's to do with the movie The Exorcist. There are some samples from it. There's a big picture there of... This is killing me that I forgot. What was the name of the actress?
I could look it up. I forgot as well, actually.
Where's Tom when you need him?
That's going to piss me off so much. I'll be there in a second.
Hold on. We're doing this in real time. And all the listeners or like every listener, Linda Blair. Why did I forget that? Yeah, you got me on the spot here, guys. But listen, there's a picture of Linda Blair on the front cover. There's samples from it. Some well-chosen samples. There's the one sample where she says, "You're going to die up there," right in the middle of the song. Very effective. The music, it's lo-fi. It is, I want to say this is like blackened grind. Or blackened gore grindish. It's very the production. It has the same production as a '90s lo-fi grindcore demo, not black metal lo-fi, but grindcore lo-fi. And I guess the difference, in my personal opinion, would be that the cymbals and the guitar kind of melt into this like staticky low end that is punctuated like a soup by meatballs of tom drums and kick drums. And the spoon is slapping, the broth is the snare drum. There's some great gurgly pitch shift. The vocals are all pitch shifter gurgles on this. So it's a really great kind of like fuzzed out grindcore production. The riffs, there's a few tracks, it's kind of like mixing it up every few songs that are just like blurry, short noisecore songs, just grinded out noisecore songs that last for a few seconds. But most of the songs are some variation on very... fundamental style, like thrash and hardcore and punk riffs, like very, you know, very, very old school, traditional, catchy riffing, kind of straight out of thrash metal and hardcore. That is maybe getting at that kind of first wave black metal idea, you know, bands like Bathory or something like that, or you know, where a lot of the second generation bands were kind of celebrating that, you know, that style. I don't want to get too deep on that, but it's just kind of like a perfect mixture of different elements. It's this lo-fi kind of DIY grind thing, but the it's obsessed with a certain specific movie, so it's got that very niche kind of, you know, worship thing that some bands do with subject matter. There's certainly a black metal element just from the subject matter alone, but also the music has this kind of callback to catchy thrash in a way. The vocals are great pitch shifter, gurgly, gore grind. It's like a perfect little marriage of elements for me, and it's also something I have a nostalgic kind of memorabilia feel for, because I was in contact with Ray Rivera when I was a teenager. I may have traded him the Liquefied Maggots demo for this or something like that. I should reach out again, maybe try to get him on the show and look up some of his later projects. But I just wanted to kind of leave it there to give a description and a reason why I enjoy this so much for the listeners. I'm more interested, Ian, in what your reaction is to this.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for all the info, because this was alien to me. I was unfamiliar. And listening to it off the jump, I fell in love with the DIY element here. I still have not dove headfirst into grind, like late 90s grindcore. And I want to, because there was a period in time where I got really into like a lot of the classic crust stuff of the early 90s, and more specifically like Scandinavian crust, like Skid System, Mob 47, Anti-Chemix, Disfear. Those were bands I really liked. And some of the slower elements here that kind of groove and take some of the punk influenced guitar riffage and then just add like a more brutalized and groove drum pattern with the vocals that are just fucking killer. That kind of harkened back to that. I mean, there's parts of those elements of these songs, if you put a D beat behind it, I would just be like, yeah, this is crust. This isn't even grind. And that's what I really, really love about it. And I guess my only hot take is, in listening to this, there's times where newer, like, power violence influence grindcore and stuff, and where grind as a genre or subgenre is seated right now, I miss shit like this. They're not afraid to like slow it down and just have it be a little bit more like, I think there's not as much punk in grind, yeah, anymore. Does that make sense? And I miss that. So this was a really, really fun listen. I only spun it through like 1.5 times, so I definitely, and it's only 10 minutes, so like I want to definitely listen to it a few more times as well. But really enjoyed it on my end.
Yeah, perfect. 10 songs in about, you know, 10 minutes and change, and it's like you said, there's a very punk kind of DIY element to this. It's very catchy and easy to listen to. And it's only about 11 minutes of your time, really, man. Definitely worth checking out. And, you know, you can look up this guy, Ray Rivera. He's got a lot of projects. I believe he's still active, like I said. I got to look him up myself. They also, just by the way, they do a cover of The Accused, the song Buried Alive, where they kind of, that's the only song on this tape where they switch up their style and actually do sound like a traditional punk hardcore band. Which is also interesting to hear because, you know, they do that cover. But it's just, it's like 11 minutes of 90s magic, and it's kind of obscure. I know that they put out that 7-inch a few years ago, but I don't really see this brought up a lot in conversation. So I just wanted to bring it up again. Any closing thoughts, Ian, before Tom takes it away?
No, all good on my end, man. I love that one.
All right, man. And Tom, please take it away with the Person Inside of Reagan demo from 1997, if you can, man. I'll send you the link. Right. So there we are, man. We gotta burn some sage right now and spread the holy water around the podcast studio after playing that. Weird stuff happened. You know, you ever read about that? The Exorcist? Like, weird stuff happened on set and all that?
You know, it's funny, dude. Without a long-winded thing, my kids, my oldest 9-year-old, he loves, like, spooky podcasts and shit that are about, like, old films. And that's one of the ones. He listened to The Wizard of Oz, like, all about the shit that got messed up on that set, and The Exorcist as well. He was very intrigued by both stories there. So
how old?
He's 9.
Wow. Damn, dude. My nephew's 6. I'm just waiting for him to get into that spooky podcast phase. That's crazy, though, man.
You got to pick and choose, though, man, because, like, some of them, the one he listens to, there'll be ones that are just like, this is going to be all about, like, some kind of, like, sexual abuse, true crime thing. I'm like, yeah, I don't know, man. You're 9. I think we'll hit that at a later date. But, yeah, like, sure, yeah. We could talk about the wacky shit that the Munchkins got into on the set of Wizard of Oz. That sounds awesome. Yeah. And the Exorcist one, I was like, yeah, fine, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Just thank God you don't have to explain Diddy to him, all right? Thank you.
Right.
Oh, God. I don't even want to get into that, man. My big concern now, are they going to go back and take him out of all the old Biggie songs? Where he's like in the background, like, yeah, you know, like the P. Diddy was always, in the words of like Suge Knight, like, oh, we up in the video, up in the song. Like, are we gonna be able to enjoy Biggie Smalls' music guilt free? That's my biggest question in all this.
My example as to why I think yes, they're gonna leave Diddy in and it's gonna be totally fine. Like, 2 weeks ago, I was talking with my wife and I said something about the movie Seven with Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman and shit, right? That like thriller. From the late 90s, and she was like, I've never seen Seven. Oof. And I was like, you never seen Seven? That's fucking crazy. She went to bed that night, and then I watched Seven, and the whole time I'm like, Kevin Spacey's fucking great in this, man. And then at the end, I was like, ooh, Kevin Spacey. Kind of forgot what happened to fucking you. Yeah. But they didn't pull him out of that. They didn't superimpose somebody else's face on his fucking head. So Diddy, I think you'll live eternally in those Notorious B.I.G. songs, but oof. That's just my take. It might be hot. They might pull them from those.
Well, it's also like, I don't really follow modern professional wrestling. We've kind of, when Justin was on air, Justin still helps us with the graphic design of the podcast. Shout out to Justin. He's still on the team. But Justin used to be a regular, as longtime listeners know, co-host. He's very up on the modern professional wrestling scene and all that sort of thing, man. I don't know what's going on. Are they going to strip Vince McMahon himself from the library like they have Chris Benoit and all these other guys?
That's a really good question.
Could they? I,
like you, am not well-versed in wrestling at all. Literally the only times I've ever heard anything about it, like Justin, a handful of times, I've got, like, has been drinking and I've been at that event, and he'll talk to me about wrestling for like an hour and a half, and I'm just like, Jesus Christ, this is awesome.
I mean, but, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I same question, you know? Like, what are they going to do? Have they said anything about that? Like, what's going on with Vince McMahon right now? Or is that kind of in limbo?
I haven't followed it that much. That was just that's my kind of question, is how does this affect the legacy of the media in a way? And it's like, with the W, if they keep erasing these wrestlers from like the old school WrestleMania, it's like eventually it's just going to be like two matches on like one of the WrestleMania. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, it's weird. I don't know, man. I don't know what the answer is. Just posing questions about music and how the music that's left behind is affected by this. It's interesting. So We're getting deep here because shout to the Lingua Brutalica podcast. Please go and check them out and listen to them. Thank you, Ian, for bringing Nocturnal to my attention this evening. The Person Inside of Reagan, classic band. Go back and listen to them. Biggie Smalls, rest in peace. I think that should about cover it for now, right?
Top to bottom, that's everything.
Ian, I didn't ask you at the top, how you been? Like, what's been going on, man? Everything cool?
Oh, yeah, it's boring as hell over here because I haven't been working, so I have a two-month-old now plus all the other three. Just keeping everybody fed, keeping everybody moving, Will. That's about it. But how about you? You've been good as well on your end?
I'm picturing you. You said kept keeping them fed and keeping them moving. I'm picturing you, like, forcing your family to jog around the yard, and you're, like, throwing treats to them that they have to catch, you know, like, while they're moving and stuff.
Treats, I think, is putting it nicely. I think it's just like a fucking mud.
Of dough with a vitamin crushed up in them.
Yeah, exactly. Get all the nutrients, but not in a pretty package. Yeah. So it's been boring. But I hope you've been good, man. I hope the puppy's good. I'm sure. I'm not sure in the last few episodes if you've been talking about.
I've been trying to refrain. I indulge that dog of mine. You know what? You want to know something? Right, here's my new little pet peeve. I never thought I'd be somebody complaining about this type of thing. People who go to the dog parks and just let their dogs run astray. And they'll be like a quarter mile. Like, they'll be like half a football field. I don't know if half a football field is a quarter mile. You might have caught me off guard with that one. But they'll be like half a football field away from you. And their dog will be running full speed at you. And they'll be like, it's okay. He's good. And my thing is, like, my dog is 8 years old and from an animal shelter. She may attack your, and she's big. She may attack your dog. Like, that's why I have a leash. You know what I mean?
You were totally allowed to feel that way because when I go to the fucking human parks, if I have my kids on a playground, there will be parents that sit down on their phones, ignore their kids. No. I had, like, since I've been on paternity leave, I had a kid probably in the ballpark of 8 to 11 years old. I was pushing my 6-year-old on the swing. He's getting the swing motion down himself, so I'm like intermittently pushing. Kid next to him, who's like I said 8 or 11 somewhere in there, is asked me to give him a push. I was like, dude, I'm not putting my hands on you. There is no world we live in where I'm touching your back even for the slightest of moments. And I was like, dude, I'm sorry, like tell mom or dad over there. Pointed at him. Yeah. You know, they're nowhere to be seen. So dog parents sometimes sucks. Human parents, they a lot of times suck too. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, dude, and that's what I'm saying. Like, when I take my nephew to the park or something like that, I'm his uncle. I'm nobody else's uncle. You know what I mean, man? And the days of, like, you know, the neighbor three doors down spanking your kid and bringing him back home, like the 50s or whatever, like that probably wasn't the best way to do it back then. And it's like, you know, it's definitely not the way to do it now. So the big rule of thumb here is when you go to the park, bring pepper spray if it's legal in your area, in your jurisdiction. I was thinking about bringing a can of Axe spray and just like whipping it out, kind of like they won't be able to tell. And I'll, you know, back your dog the fuck up. You know, not that I would do it. That was a joke, by the way. That wasn't a serious thing. Anyway, before I get myself in any more hot water here, we're on Patreon. We got a couple little bonus joints there. All the money goes into a big pot that we're collecting to go strictly to the production of this podcast and the future future equipment, not weed. Don't listen to my voice right now. future equipment production, possibly future on location podcast that we may record, things like that. So the money is being preserved. It's not just going to buy Big Will legal New York State weed. My alleged day job does that. Music certainly doesn't. So heavyholepodcast@gmail.com if you want to drop us a line or you picture your social media. We're on the good ones and some of the bad ones if you look hard enough, maybe. I don't know. Drop us a line. Let us know what you want to recommend, what you don't like. Did I say something you like? Did I say something you don't like? Do you want me to shut up? You guys really want me to keep doing this thing? I've been doing it a few years now. Let me know if you want me to just cut it out, all right? Let me know if you like the sound of my voice better when I'm sounding like a frog over death metal and you don't want me to do this anymore. Be real. Voicemail is in the description wherever you listen to this. And I think that about does it, Ian. Do you have any commentary, anything you want to get off your chest? I think we're in the clear here.
Ran the gamut. We hit everything.
Yeah. Yeah, we did. We didn't literally hit anything, guys. Especially not
not
dogs. Okay, we definitely didn't hit any dogs today. No animals were harmed in the production of this podcast, I assure you. Especially not this little one.